So we're on lesson three. We're talking about hierarchicalism and its influence in the church and two particular ways. One that we talked about last week was the idea of the veneration of the saints and how that whole idea came about. That did not emerge through reflection on biblical truth, but various other factors, cultural factors, led to the development of that whole idea. And then today we're going to talk about the development of the office of bishop. And that was also influenced by the hierarchical mindset in the culture, and then also through some pragmatic reactions to various issues that were confronting the church. So we're on page two, where it says the office of bishop, page two of lesson three. So the office of bishop in the New Testament, there are passages that speak of bishops. We don't, most English translations do not translate the word bishop. They translate it as overseer. But that's the word. It's the same word in Greek. And the Greek word is episkopos, and that's where we get the name episcopal to describe a hierarchical form of church government. What churches have that episcopal form of church government? Yeah, the Episcopal Church. Yeah, so the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church is the Anglican Church just in America. But then there are churches that have split off from the American denomination. They would also be hierarchical. And yeah, the Roman Catholic Church. You think of any others? Lutherans are interesting. Lutherans view church government as you can do it however you want, kind of. Not each denomination can do it however they want, but in different countries it works differently. They have different. Yeah. I don't know if they're hierarchical or not. No, yeah. Good point. Presbyterianism is not hierarchical, but it has graded courts. Okay, so there's a distinction there because there's no office above that of elder. There's only one office of rule in the church, and it's that of elder. And that's really supported by the New Testament, that even the Apostle Peter refers to himself as a fellow elder. So he's an apostle, and that's an extraordinary office, but he also was an elder. And really, when the church gathered for the council at Jerusalem in Acts 15, yeah, there were elders meeting with the apostles, but the elders had an equal vote. It was, you know, so that the office of rule was the office of elder. So there's no office above elder, but there are graded courts, and that's really just a matter of establishing a way for the church to be connectional. And also that's supported by Acts 15 because that synod or that council made a decision and it was binding on the churches. But it wasn't a top-down type of a thing because those participating in that synod or council were elders of the local churches. So it wasn't hierarchical. So it's a little bit different, but it's... Yeah, the Eastern Orthodox Church would be hierarchical. Yeah, and the Methodist Church is hierarchical also. They have bishops, and because they were split off of the Church of England, really. So in the New Testament, though, the word bishop, or usually translated overseer, is used interchangeably with the Greek word for elder, which is presbyteros. So they're used interchangeably, and you see this in a couple of passages. Acts 20, if you want to turn there. And the other is in Titus 1. I just want to point these out because it's very helpful to see this, because it's just so clear. And there are no passages in the Bible where the word episkopos, or overseer, or bishop, is used to describe a hierarchical office. There's nowhere in the New Testament where the word is used to describe the office of bishop as it stands in hierarchical churches. There's just no such thing as far as the New Testament is concerned. And a bishop, as far as the New Testament is concerned, is an elder. And an elder is a bishop. Okay, it's the same office. So in Acts 20, verse 17, Paul is going to meet with the elders of the church in Ephesus. It says, "Now from Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called the elders of the church to come to him." So he's talking to elders. Skip down to verse 28. As he's talking to them, he says, "Pay careful attention to yourselves and to all the flock in which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers to care for the church of God." Okay? So they're elders and they're overseers. It's the same office. Flip over to Titus 1. Titus 1, verses 5 and 7. Paul, writing to Titus, says, "This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you." And then skip over to verse 7. "For an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach." Okay? Elders are overseers. The exact same office. And remember the Greek words here. The Greek word for elder is presbyteros, which is where we get the name Presbyterian. The Greek word for overseer is episkopos, which is, again, that's the word behind bishop. So you could translate it bishop if you want, but we translate it overseer because that actually is more helpful in describing what the office does. The elders of the church oversee the flock. So they refer to the same office. The former term, overseer, describes the responsibility of the office. Okay? And so, you know, it's just one way of describing the office. Whereas the term elder describes the qualifications for the office, the maturity, especially the spiritual maturity that's required for the office. So it's just kind of just two different ways of describing the office. So, again, there is no biblical support for a hierarchical office of bishop. It's just not there. And here's a quote from Michael Horton. He says, "Interestingly, Orthodox theologian John Ziziulus and Pope Benedict both acknowledge Presbyterian polity as the earliest form of church government. However, churches in both the East and the West began to imitate the hierarchical political system of the empire." So, and they're in writing, both of those, that Eastern Orthodox theologian and the Pope himself, they're both in print saying, yes, Presbyterianism was the earliest form of church government. They're acknowledging that. So, why aren't they Presbyterian? They should be.
How do they get out of saying that? Because that would be considered tradition, like the Catholic Church, the whole tradition. How would they get away from that tradition?
Well, they believe that tradition develops. And so they believe that it developed, they would say that the seeds of the hierarchicalism were there. They were there in the office of apostle. Okay? And they would say that was transmitted and passed down. So they would say it was there in seed form. It just hadn't germinated yet in the New Testament. And that as the church, and there is such a thing as development of doctrine. But the Roman Catholic Church has a very different understanding, way of understanding that, and really uses and misuses that idea in order to try to justify all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, even in order to try to explain away clear contradictions in Roman Catholic teaching. You know, it used to be, and I mean, there was a pope who said this. I think it was Pope Urban, in a formal declaration called Unum Sanctum. He said, there is no possibility of salvation outside the Roman Catholic Church. Absolutely none. Okay? But at Vatican II, the Roman Catholic Church now says, well, actually, you could technically be an atheist and make it to heaven. Just so you live according to the light you've been given. You know, and you can see how that is actually a consistent way of thinking about salvation. If the Roman Catholic understanding of salvation is really works-oriented, then you can see how, if you do enough good, even though you may not know Christ, you'll make it. So there is, in some ways, a consistency there, and yet there's an explicit contradiction. So, anyways. So how did this office of monarchical bishop emerge? And the reason why they're called monarchical is these are bishops as monarchs, bishops as hierarchical heads in the church. How did this emerge? Well, it developed over time. At first, the form of church government was Presbyterian, but it pretty quickly moved to an episcopal form of church government where you did have this hierarchy. Bishops above priests, and then even eventually archbishops over bishops. And then from there it went to from episcopal to papal, where you had the bishop of Rome, the pope, being the head over everything. So initially, though, the title of bishop or overseer was first given to what we would call today the moderators of sessions or the moderators of presbyteries. It was more just a functional type of a thing. It was not that there was anything about the office itself that elevated it above others. It was more just functional. Then churches were first established in cities over the first couple centuries of church history. And converts from the surrounding rural areas would go to the city to worship. And then eventually you would have kind of church plants or satellite churches in the countryside. And because everything started at that urban center, that church in the city, the bishop in that church would have authority over those churches in the diocese. That's how the idea of a diocese emerged. And bishops came to have authority over the priests in a region. And it's interesting that this is something Robert Godfrey points out. The English word priest is actually a contraction of the Greek word presbyter. It actually, the word doesn't come into English from the Old Testament and the Old Testament office of priest. It actually comes from the title elder. So the first priests were simply elders. You know, so actually you could, even though you wouldn't want to do this because there's so much confusion wrapped around the term, but you could use the word priest to describe the elders of the church, you know, because it's just a contraction of the Greek word presbyter. But again, we wouldn't do that because we wouldn't want to confuse people. Yes. Well, we wouldn't want to see the reason why I wouldn't want to use the word priest is because of it. I wouldn't want to use it in reference to a special office in the church, because Christ is the one true high priest, and we and all Christians share in his priesthood. So I wouldn't want to say that there's one office, a special office of priest in the church today, because of the confusion there. But initially, though, the word actually was not used. It didn't start being used because of some kind of an idea of a mediatorial office or something like that. It was simply a contraction of the word presbyter, you know. So
it's interesting. We were listening to Strobel on the way up, and he was talk about the subject and how, as he related it back to last time, how he said that Jesus was the supreme overseer.
Okay, yeah, there is that word overseer is, yeah, it is used in reference to Christ in one or two passages. Yeah, you're right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, Ben, you were going to ask something.
I was just going to say, do you basically think the same thing with saints, the way that we use saints is all people, you know, all Christians are saints, whereas they take the form of a special office.
Right, yeah. Yeah, similar, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, now as far as how did this idea of hierarchy emerge? Well, it was a pragmatic response to problems that were confronting the church. Heresies were emerging in those first few centuries. We've already talked about two of them. We talked about the Gnostic heresy, and we talked about Montanist heresy. And the church responded to those heresies by saying, you know, because people were wondering, well, how do we know which church to go to? How do we know which minister to listen to? And the way the leaders of the church responded was to say, here, it's easy. Just listen to the bishop. Just listen to the bishop, because the bishops are the successors of the apostles, and you know you're going to be safe. Just listen to the bishop, and you'll be fine. So they developed this idea of apostolic succession, that the office of apostle, which is the foundational office, the office upon which the church is built, according to Paul in Ephesians 2:20, that office, that the apostles actually, it was not an office that died with the death of the last apostle, but it actually continues. And it continues by virtue of apostolic succession. The apostles pass on the baton to the bishops who succeeded them. So that was the claim. But the big problem with this, can you guess what it is? Okay, yeah, why do you keep laying a foundation? If the nature of the office is to lay the foundation so that the church can be built on it, why do you have a need to keep, yeah, good point. What's another basic reason why this is problematic?
You can't prove it
from Scripture. Exactly, yeah. There is absolutely nothing in the Scriptures to talk about apostolic succession. Now, Paul talks about Timothy needing to pass on the faith to others. But that's Timothy. He's not an apostle. You know, this is not talking about passing on an office. It's talking about passing on sound doctrine. Okay? That's, yeah, that needs to happen. But there's just no support for this idea of the office of apostle being handed down. So it's not an idea that was derived from Scripture. It's an idea that was derived or developed as the church wondered, how in the world are we going to prevent heresy from dividing the church? We've got to have some way to deal with this. And they came up with that method. Yeah, Jeff.
I think the correct answer may have been to get together and recognize and confirm time. Obviously, God does things in his own time. It happened at the exact time it's supposed to, but that just seems more.
Yeah.
And even the answer is Bible centered rather than man centered.
Yeah.
You know, because really and truly, what people were asking was, who should we listen to for correct doctrine?
Yeah.
Not who should we listen to so that we can obey.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know what? It's you have a New Testament precedent for how to handle controversy, right? Acts 15, the Jerusalem Council. You know? Hey, what do you do when there's a question about something? You call a council. You have a synod. Presbytery decides the issue. Okay? You know, that would have been the way to do it. Yeah. And they did call councils. You know, and that was, you know, there was the Council of Nicaea. Yeah. So, but this was part of the answer, and this part of it wasn't good. Yeah.
That's exactly that concept. love churches because they believe the church and the church government is the highest form of government within the.
You mean the local church? Independency. Yeah, that's the other form of church government, which is just the local church. But again, you see how that's problematic. That isolates that local congregation from how can the church be Catholic at that point? You know, lowercase Catholic there. How can it be universal if it's just this one little church? There needs to be a connectionalism. And again, Acts 15, Jerusalem Council. You know, I think you see that connectionalism in operation there. So it was really a pragmatic thing. And the church then, from there, once it has established this idea of apostolic succession, began to think that there was a hierarchy among bishops, and that the bishops who were in the most important cities were at the top. And then church power and authority came to be seen as hierarchical. And there were five cities in particular that were deemed the most important, and the bishops in those cities were the patriarchs of the church. And the church, those cities were Jerusalem. Not because the church was real strong there, but because of the history there. Antioch in Syria, Alexandria in Egypt, Constantinople, which was the new capital of the Roman Empire, after Constantine moved his capital there. That's up at the very tip, the far northern part of Asia Minor, Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul, and then Rome. So those were the five patriarchs. Exactly. Yeah. So Rome is the only one in the West. Helps you see why it emerged too, because there was a split between the eastern and western parts of the empire. So how did the Bishop of Rome rise to the top of everyone? Well, some of the popes, the bishops of Rome, claimed preeminence simply because, well, Rome is the most important city in the empire. And so, I should be at the top of the heap. You see this sort of thing even today, like I'm pastor of a big church in New York City, that sort of thing can happen, and does happen. And it may not even be self-conscious on the part of the individual, but it could be, people that look up to that individual because of the prestige of the position. But Rome, the Bishop of Rome had always enjoyed a special kind of prestige, but it was really more of an idea of first among equals, at least initially. That, Rome, because Rome is so important, there is a special prestige there, but there was no sense that Rome was actually over the other patriarchs. And there was no... It's interesting, this is not on your outline, but just some other thoughts. There's no evidence for a monarchical bishop in Rome until the middle of the 2nd century. Now, I think that's significant. Now, the 2nd century, that's pretty early, AD 140, 150, somewhere in there. But still, that's half a century after the death of the last apostle. That's a pretty big gap. How does apostolic succession work there when you have 50 to 60 years without a monarchical bishop there? Obviously, the baton must have been dropped. So what's going on there? So there is, even though Rome calls Peter the first pope, he was not the pope in any sense in which we think of the pope today. And really, there's no evidence that he was in this any kind of an office like this. The first bishop of Rome, I believe, is a guy named Linus. In the Peanuts comic strip, that guy, he's the pope. But Jeff.
Like Eusebius in his church histories, he says Linus was the first bishop after the apostles, but even though he gravitated towards more like an Episcopalian one.
Yeah.
Whether you're correct or not, but both Paul and Peter
Yeah.
And then he does say Linus was the first actual
pope.
Post-apostolic bishop.
Yeah.
He didn't say pope, he just says.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, Mike.
So how do we change from bishop to pope, the word?
The word? Yeah, I mean the word just derives from the Latin for father, you know. I think it was just a way of trying to elevate and distinguish the Bishop of Rome from the other, because you know the word patriarch also means father, you know, so it was, I think I don't know exactly how it developed, but it was a way to distinguish the Bishop of Rome. But also there's no evidence that the Bishop of Rome claimed to have any jurisdictional authority outside of Rome until the 3rd century. So again, that's a significant period of time. This idea evolved over time. So you have on your outline there a couple of dates. AD 250, Pope Stephen cites Matthew 16 to support his claim to preeminence by divine right, that he is the head of the church. The problem with that, going to that passage, you know, that's where Jesus says to Peter, and you are, I call you Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, you know. Well, the problem with that is it's pretty clear when you look at that passage in context that it's not Peter himself that's the foundation. It's Peter as the proclaimer of the truth about Christ. It's the one who gives the apostolic testimony. And we know that because when Peter, 2 verses later, says the wrong thing about Jesus, Jesus calls him Satan. And he says, "Get behind me, Satan." You know, so it's not Peter himself. It's Peter as bearer of or proclaimer of the gospel. But also, Jesus says the same basic thing to all of the apostles 2 chapters later in Matthew 18. You know, what you bind will be bound, what you loose will be loosed, and then in John chapter 20. So it's Jesus says this to the apostles as a whole, and I think when you interpret these passages together, and in light of what Paul says in Ephesians 2:20, it becomes clear that there is just no support for this idea of Petrine supremacy. You know, Peter as the supreme head of the church. There's no support for that from the Bible, because what Jesus is saying to Peter in Matthew 16 is the same thing that Paul says in Ephesians 2:20, that the church is built on the foundation of the apostolic testimony. That's all Jesus is saying. He's not singling out Peter, because he says the same thing to all of the apostles. Again, so it's just Peter is simply in Matthew 16, he's the spokesman for the apostles, as he frequently is. He's the guy who can't keep his mouth shut, you know. So he's the one who speaks for them on behalf of them. Jeff.
The other apostles view him that way, like in Acts 15.
Yeah.
James, the brother of Jesus, is
yeah.
head of the council.
He's the moderator, basically.
He sends Peter out.
Yeah. Yeah. Peter does not function the way you would expect a pope to function in Acts 15. That's a huge strike against this whole idea. Yeah. So. Then Pope Leo I, who was a really significant, this is Leo the Great, he was very significant in consolidating power and setting up the office of pope. And he claimed that all church power proceeded from him, that he's at the top. But this was not something that was universally agreed upon. There's lots of disagreement with this. Cyprian, who was the bishop of Carthage in Egypt, he said this: "Neither does any of us set himself up as a bishop of bishops, nor by tyrannical terror does any compel his colleague to the necessity of obedience." And so Cyprian was not in agreement with this. The Council of Nicaea was not in agreement with this idea. That he said that each church center, or the council said, each church center is to be ruled by its own bishop and not by one bishop over all those bishops. And then Gregory the First, interestingly, Gregory the Great, who was Bishop of Rome, and this is all the way into the, well, he dies in 604, he said this: whoever calls himself universal bishop or wishes to be so called is in his self-exaltation Antichrist's precursor. For in his swaggering he sets himself before the rest. You know, now Gregory in a lot of ways did consolidate church power, and yet here we have a quote from a pope saying that if any pope claims to be head of the church, he is actually the Antichrist. You know, so it's just ironic. But so the Eastern Church was never convinced by this idea that the pope is the head of over the whole church. And that was one of the major factors that led to the split between the Eastern and Western churches right around the year 1000. 1054 AD is usually recognized as the date for that split. So the Eastern churches were never convinced that Rome held supremacy, but the West eventually did and acknowledged the primacy of Rome. So.
When we use the word papacy,
yeah.
is that an adjective or is that a noun?
That would be a noun, papacy, yeah. The adjective would be papal, you know, papal power or, yeah. So, yeah, the noun papacy is just describing the office. Yes? Bill?
Number four,
yeah, why don't you distribute that? We'll zip through this quickly and we'll kind of come back to it next fall. Does the Eastern Church what? Does the Eastern Orthodox Church have their own pope? Well, no. I mean, what they have is the Bishop of Constantinople is kind of, he's the patriarch of all patriarchs, and yet I don't think it's a, I don't know. Does anyone know? The Coptic Christians, yeah, that's kind of a splinter group. They may have their own head too. Yeah, I'm not sure. But I think the idea is more shared authority, but practically it may work that the Bishop of Constantinople is at the top. But I'm not sure how all that has worked out. All right, so we'll just begin this. We're talking now in this lesson about the church in the Roman Empire. And prior to the conversion of Constantine, which we'll talk about in just a moment here, Christianity was an illegal religion. It was not a recognized religion in the Roman Empire. And again, Constantine is converted in the early 4th century. So that's, you know, 300 years of persecution, or at least being illegal, the threat of persecution. Persecution could erupt at any moment, and did erupt at various moments. Now, Judaism was given special privileges in the Roman Empire because it was viewed as a national religion, an ethnic religion. And the Romans made some exceptions for Judaism. But over time, Christians were not, that exception was not granted to Christians because it wasn't seen as an ethnic thing. Now, some Christians were motivated to continue going to synagogue because they wanted to fall under, they wanted to kind of be grandfathered in or, you know, fall under the umbrella of the protections that were extended to Judaism. There were three major accusations that Romans brought against Christians. One was atheism. Christians are atheists because they don't worship the Roman gods. And also, they don't have any statues of their god. So they must not believe in God. National disloyalty or treason, because they're not willing to participate in the imperial cult. The Romans put a lot of stock in civil religion or civic religion. That was the bond that held society together. And if you weren't willing to participate, you were being unpatriotic. And then Christians were also accused of immorality. And this was largely due to just misunderstandings, because Christians, because of the threat of persecution, had to meet in secret. The pagans would hear about what they were doing when they met. They eat the body and blood of. They must sacrifice people and eat. They must be cannibals, they started getting some weird ideas that were not really founded in any facts. So over time, initially there was persecution in isolated places. It just emerged depending on conditions in local areas. But then eventually the attitude of the emperor towards the Christian faith was a factor that led to empire-wide persecution. And two of the most severe persecutions are listed here under Decius and Diocletian. Decius required everyone to possess a certificate stating that he had sacrificed to the gods. And that, unfortunately, resulted in wide-scale apostasy. There were a lot of Christians who caved in, and either did sacrifice to the gods or they paid somebody to get their certificate when they hadn't actually done the sacrificing themselves. So the church responded to that by increasing their instruction of Christians and exercising discipline. And there was a big controversy about, well, what do you do with Christians who lapsed during this persecution? You know, those who denied the faith or those who worshipped other gods, can they be reinstituted? Is apostasy a forgivable sin? And that was a debate There was not a lot of agreement initially on that. There were significant leaders in the church that said, no, you cannot be forgiven of apostasy. What do you think about that? Can you be forgiven of apostasy? And if so, where would you go in the Bible to support that? Yes, Bill. Yeah. Right. You can understand why people would give in. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I think, you know, it's unfortunate that that wasn't looked at more closely. But I mean, eventually the church did believe that the official position was that you can be restored. Peter denied Christ, and he was restored. So I think, yes, apostasy can be forgiven. It's not the unforgivable sin. Yes, Nancy. Right, right, yeah. Right. Yeah, there's... yeah. It gets down to the distinction between Peter and Judas, even in light of the things Jesus says about them, it gets down to Peter was one of the elect. Judas was not. Judas was a son of perdition. He was one of the reprobate. When Judas apostatized, he was showing his true colors. It doesn't. So when we say apostasy can be forgiven, we're not saying that it always will be. You know, there is such a thing as final apostasy, where a person who appeared to be a true Christian renounces Christ and walks away, and that's that. The thing is, we don't know. We don't have insight into a person's heart, so we can't look into the Book of Life and tell who's written in the Book of Life or not. So when somebody apostatizes, we don't know whether or not they're one of the elect or not. But Christ obviously did. So that's the difference between the two. Yeah, yeah, that's the time. Yeah, obviously. If not, Decius was like a one-year-old emperor. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a short. Yeah, it was short. Yeah. Diocletian. So there was a bit of a respite in between their two reigns. Diocletian ordered the destruction of churches, the surrender of Bibles. He outlawed gatherings for worship. And those persecutions were met with much more faithfulness among Christians. There were still a number who caved in, but the church had grown stronger, and more people were willing to. Most execution was kind of a last resort. You know, they would do lots of other things. They had lots of other tricks, you know, up their sleeve. Execution was kind of the last resort. They didn't do that, you know, automatically in most cases. You know, usually it was, there were financial penalties. You'd be removed from, if you were a Christian in a prominent position in society, you'd be removed from that position. If you were a servant, you might be reclaimed, or, you know, you might be made a slave of somebody who's not a Christian. There are lots of different ways that that they could persecute people, short of killing them. So they did kill. Lots of Christians did get killed, but there were lots of other ways in which Christians suffered. And but in spite of all that, the church did grow. By A.D. 300, roughly 7 million of the Roman Empire's 50 million inhabitants were Christians, and that's about 15%. That may not seem like much, but, you know, when you think about the context of persecution and opposition and being an illegal religion, I don't know, I think that's pretty impressive, especially when you think of the beginnings of Christianity. I think it's pretty amazing that the church grew that quickly in that kind of a context. And the largest population of Christians was in Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey, and there were significant minorities in Egypt and in Rome. So I think that's where we'll stop. We're out of time, but any questions? I mean that, you know, they were a sizable part of the population. You know, it was a minority. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't that the majority of the population in Rome was Christian, but, you know, they were a presence in Rome. So you could, maybe the moral minority, you know. Any other questions? All right, well, we will resume next fall with a discussion of Constantine. That's a major turning point in church history, the conversion of Constantine. So that's a good place to pick up in the fall.